Chapter 22. That is not quite the end. It is a defeat, one that forces a hurried withdrawal, but it is not quite the end. The apostles of the Weeping Veil remain cohesive, and they remain powerful. They are driven from the chapel by force of numbers and the sudden switch of momentum, but Morjalchek does not die in the rout. He leads them out into the shattered remains of the fortress, and there they rally. For a while after that, the outcome remains uncertain. Remnants of the White Consuls make a final counteroffensive, led by their captain Memnon, which retakes one of the main bastion towers. The Death Guard, having committed heavily to contain the threat at the chapel, are beaten back across three other sectors by vengeful squads of word-bearers. Amid the smoke and the debris, orders are lost, mistakes are made. The attrition rate begins to bite, and gunships come down in gouts of burning promethium. But the time of decision has been passed, and now fate runs in one direction only. Slurt's toxins are filtered through every part of the underfortress, and more of the living dead emerge, steadily adding to the hosts that now march with the Lords of Silence. The threat of the Neverborn recedes. The barrier between worlds does not weaken further, and soon the only demons stalking down those flame-raked streets are plague-bearers and little lords, spreading their blights gleefully like pheromones. With his great objective denied him, there is only so much of this pain that Morjalchek is willing to tolerate for Sabatine. After a savage feint in which an entire segment of the inner citadel is demolished by timed incendiaries, his orbital landers finally fight their way down. This is a dangerous maneuver, and a number of the dropships are lost before they can pull away again, but a substantial proportion of the Weeping Veil makes it into orbit, pursued by the Death Guard's surviving Thunderhawks. With their numbers thinned and their pride crushed, there is no reckoning to be had in the void, and the Iamanda beats for the Mandeville Point. Vorks lets it go, for there is still hard fighting on the surface, though he permits Hovik to shadow for a while, keeping all guns trained on the cruiser until it retreats fully into the void. Then there is merely the slow death of the fortress to be attended to. The last of its defenders are hunted, run down in their final bastions, overwhelmed at last by the air that chokes and the flies that blind. The baseline humans by then are either truly dead or corrupted by the gathering smog, and it is only the Space Marines who remain, incapable of despair, even as their world finally comes crashing in on them and all hope is snuffed out. There is no wanton cruelty. Vorks is true to his word. Those who are not killed in the fighting are given an honorable death. Countless numbers of humans are inducted into the half-life of thraldom, their wills extinguished and their souls crushed. But the Lords of Silence do not see that fate as something to mourn. For them, it is an improvement on what went before. And so Vigilia Carceris is taken, its foundations scoured and its archives burned. Little lords dance across the proud parapets, defecating on the symbols of the immortal Imperium, while the waves crash futilely below, starved of their energy by the unnatural humidity. It will be recorded in later years that this was the first great loss of an Adeptus Astartes homeworld in the aftermath of the Cicatrix Maledictum. Scholars on Terra will make note of Sabatine's destruction, and fear that it presages the start of an unstoppable tide. Events will be set in motion as a result, decisions made, desperate pacts sealed. At the time, though, whether on Terra or within the Imperium Nihilus, none of this is guessed at. All that is known is that a battle has been won, and the god of decay has been well served. The last of the flags come down. The guns fall silent. Hunched monsters with pale green eyes emerge into an uncertain haze, their movements slowing again, their helms venting breathily. Over the burning metal and the rotting flesh, a pall descends. Slowly, uncertainly, as if all such mundane things are now to be questioned in this universe of change, it begins to rain. He stumbles through the ruins, breathing heavily. The pain in his chest seems to have gone now. He barely remembers he had it. He does not see well. Everything is grey, like rancid milk. Other bodies, rough around the edges like his, are like ghosts. Occasionally, one will blunder up to him, and they will stare at one another, trying to recall something important. Then the other one will lose interest and shuffle back into the mists. He has killed many people. He knows this because their blood is still hot on his hands. He licks this blood from time to time, and for a while afterwards he feels more defined. It is not necessarily a pleasant sensation, for the pain comes back quickly too, and his eyes are sore. It feels better to sink back into that vague sense of not quite there, the blurring of awareness, and the softening embrace of dreams. He is conscious of a narrowing. It is like the world is closing in around him, both fading and becoming heavier. He is permanently cold now, and things are drying up. He does not sweat, and his mouth is parched. He limps past the sharp edge of a bombed-out building. One half of an eagle motif, double-headed, lies in the ruins. He stares at it for a while, wondering why it is making him feel terrible. He doubts that he could be properly sick now, even if he wanted to, but the feeling of nausea is still possible, so he hurries on. Eventually, he is on the edge of the city. He can smell salt, and he feels a chill wind against his face. He shivers, wondering if he should go back the way he came. The walls are little more than piles of broken stone. He could just keep on walking, and the cliff edge will come. For some reason, he knows how steep those cliffs are, and how far he would fall. The rain is freezing, and what remains of his clothing sticks to his body. He staggers. He slips. Before long, the walls are behind him, and the rocks are becoming slippery with foam. He can hear the crash of surf, and he sees clouds racing. It will not take long. He will hardly feel it. But then there is a shape in the mist, a pillar of stone that slides out of the fog.
"Captain Dantine," says the pillar.
He concentrates hard. The pillar becomes larger and more defined, swelling into the colossal shape of a monster. It moves, and he sees arms and legs. There are fat little horrors that squat all over it, and books hanging from chains about its neck. A ragged cowl is sodden in the downpour.
"Captain Dantine," the monster says again, "stay where you are."
The thing comes closer. He does as he is told, of course. He waits, panting softly, the rainwater coursing over what remains of his body. From somewhere, he pulls out a name. Philemon. The corpse counter. The monster looks in bad shape, wounded perhaps, or merely bedraggled. Amid all the flotsam and junk that festoons his body, there are bags hanging at his belt, and some are damp with something thicker than water.
"You are hard to find," says Philemon irritably. "I thought we might have lost you already. By the god, look at you."
He can barely understand the words. Everything is grey. His only motivation, to the extent that he still has one, is to keep walking and maybe find that drop into oblivion. Philemon reaches for his belt and pulls out a pouch, one that looks vaguely familiar.
"Vaux is not wholly pleased with me," he says. "I should have trusted him a little more," he thinks. "Not taken so much initiative. And so I have a number of penances to perform, and one of them, it seems, is you."
The monster comes closer, and he can feel rotten breath on his face. That stirs a memory. He reaches up to his chest, and a faint throb can be detected there again.
"Vaux is grateful to you," Philemon says. "Vaux thinks it would be a waste to let you go. He wants to find a way to keep you."
He looks at the bag. Dimly, he is horrified by it.
"I don't know what we'll do exactly, given how far you've dropped, but something might be worked out," Philemon says. "There are ways and there are means. Restorative magics. Come with me now."
He hesitates. He could keep going, head into that grey obliteration.
It would be the end of all of it.
His fingers are shaking. It is so, so cold. He looks up at the monster. It is waiting for him.
Then, inevitably, his head drops.
He nods. He begins to turn back towards the ruined city. The monster falls in alongside him.
"Don't look so miserable," it says. "You've been chosen for some reason. Vorks will find a way for you to serve."
He takes no pleasure in that. He takes no pleasure in anything. As he stumbles, he looks at the bag swinging in the monster's clenched claw. He watches it sway and feels that he hates it. But there's nothing to be done. No resistance. He keeps walking and knows the dark ship is next. They will not let him go. He puts one foot before the other, then the next. An automatic movement.
Damn them. They will not let him go.
It takes a long time for Slurt to reemerge. He has been travelling far, arranging for more deployments of the contagions. Tankers have been dropped from Solus, and these are now travelling out across the Highlands, escorted by squads of Unbroken. There are cities waiting, teeming still with life and possibility. Most of them are already under assault from their indigenous phage creatures, but the process can always be given a helping hand. It takes a while, even for someone of Slurt's talents, to infect an entire world. He will need to be patient. Still, there is much to be satisfied with. The toxins he released into the Citadel were effective, just as they needed to be. They have a new army now, enough to replenish the losses they took fighting the Weeping Veil and the White Consuls. Many Unbroken were slain, it is true, and those will take a long time to replace. But such is war. The God will provide, in some form or other. Slurt returns from the western road, heading back towards the smouldering citadel. Already dark green algae are beginning to blotch on the bare rock, fed by the rain that has become a constant stream. A world that was once hard-edged and driven is now softening, filling up, mouldering and warming. He can hear buzzing and smell the sweetening of the rotting flesh as the pace of decay quickens. The ruins of Vigilia Carceris rise up in front of him, a sodden mass of roofless towers. Its bulk is still considerable, but its symmetry has gone. It stinks already, and Slurt can see the pestilences cradling within it. Given a little time, it will blossom into its full potential. Perhaps Vorks will make it a fortress of his own, a place within which to gather strength. Or perhaps they will leave soon, taking the victory and striking out into the deep void. Just as he thinks of the Siege Master, Slurt sees him approaching, limping down the old road from the shattered gates. He salutes and walks towards him. In the background, an orbital lifter is coming down, churning its way through the rain, bringing more delights for the conversion of this world.
"A victory!" says Slurt.
Vorks comes to a halt, shrugs, but does not disagree.
"How goes the work? There are millions here. We could do something with this place."
He looks at the Siege Master carefully.
"If you wanted to."
Vorks says nothing. He seems morose.
"A shame," says Slurt. "What happened to Clado? We'll need to think about what we do for a surgeon now."
Vorks nods.
"A great shame. Something will turn up." "And the ship?"
Slurt feels like he is pressing now.
"What happened?"
Vorks sighs. It rumbles out from his colossal chest, and the numerals on the battle plate seem to shift and align in the poor light.
"A mystery putrefier. Some quirk of the warp, triggered by what we did over Agrippina, I judge. I will ask Philemon to continue his investigation." "He has not uncovered much so far." "No, he has not. He did not serve me well." "But I served you well, didn't I?
Did I not, Siege Master?
Finally, Vaux looks at him.
You did, Slurt. Your plagues were things of magnificence. I wish you to continue with them. Turn this whole world into a new garden. You can do this for me?
With great pleasure, Lord.
Vaux is looking out at the highlands now, watching them drown in the rain. Slurt knows he is imagining what will happen to them. The sloughs, the rot, the pools of stagnant water. It is surprising how fast things can change with a will.
And after that?
Slurt ventures, uncertain how far to push things.
Ultramar, or some other place.
Vaux thinks for a long time. He looks old now, terribly old, like something dragged up from the base of a primordial mire. This war has been going on for so very long.
All things are possible now, Putrefier,
he says eventually, starting to walk again, still limping.
All things are possible.
That was The Lords of Silence by Chris Raitt, read by John Banks.
This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2018.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.